You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Earth Justice Attorney Stephanie Sotsi, representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and their fight to prevent the Dakota Access Pipeline from running through their sacred burial grounds and precipitously close to their water supply. Also joining us, Jordan Chariton, TYT reporter, who's literally just got off a plane from North Dakota. Also on the program, Trump TV is Plan B. Plan A apparently appears to be avoid a pay-to-look-away scandal. The percentage of uninsured in this country is now at a historic low. And Zika funding also remains at an historic low of zero. The Senate and the Congress cannot pass funding for Zika. A Dallas AM newspaper has done something they haven't done since just after World War II. Hillary's still sick and also still getting Wall Street cash. North Carolina still innovating voter suppression. And Obama nominates the first Muslim ever to a federal judgeship. And then finally, some good news. I don't know why this struck me as so good, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced, I don't know if they did it today or yesterday. I don't know why this got me, maybe, I don't know, because Saul now is, he's into whales a little bit, and we're making whales noises. I don't know. I don't know why he does these things. But the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, apparently announced yesterday, Tuesday, that the majority of the world's humpback species, maybe that's not correct, or I should say the majority of different humpback whale population segments, have been removed from the endangered species list. Apparently, there are 14 different population segments of humpback whales around the world. And they used to just be humpback whales on the endangered species list. Now they've been isolated so that you can get more attention on those who have yet to recover. Humpbacks will still receive protection in the U.S. waters under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And they will, the International Whaling Commission's moratorium on commercial whaling will also remain in place. So apparently, many of the day-to-day protections and activities will continue to occur, but it probably has to do with more tangential issues about habitats and whatnot. The four humpback populations that remain listed as endangered include those that frequent waters in the Pacific Northwest, Central America, the Arabian Sea, and Northwest Africa. This delisting takes place, and I want you to just note the order of this. More than 40 years of federal protection under the Endangered Species Act. And an international ban on commercial whaling that has been in place since 1982. So you've had a ban on commercial whaling internationally for, what, 34 years. And you've had a federal protection for more than 40. This is relevant because even though when they passed that federal protection 40 years ago, I'm sure there were people who said, this is useless. They're getting killed around the world. It shows that this is the way you make progress in issues like this. So on the heels of Obama and China signing a deal to cut emissions, carbon emissions, obviously inadequate, but this is the way it works. And I will say also that it also is indicative of the fact that despite the fact that we're not gods here, it's not arrogant of us to think that, hey, if we're destroying a population of mammals in this case around the world, we can actually stop the destruction of it. We, you know, like a story like this would have more salience if this was a race between, let's say, Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz, or frankly, any other Republican. I mean, of course, Donald Trump thinks that global warming is a hoax, but he doesn't bother to even go beyond that. Ted Cruz would say, like, it's arrogant for us to think that we can change the planet. This is just another example of that. That, yeah, we actually, our behavior has actually some impact on the world around us. And so when you talk about the protests that are going on in this Dakota Access Pipeline, these small things sometimes grow into a much larger and have much larger relevance. You know, we've mentioned in the past that Black Lives Matter has been there. You've seen what I think, and maybe our next guest might know, or one of our next guests might know, but what has been an unprecedented reunification of Native American tribes around these protests that are taking place in North Dakota, in Standing Rock. And you're seeing environmentalists. I mean, this is how people learn how to build movements. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Earth Justice attorney Stephanie Tsotsi. Just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its support. So if you have the wherewithal, and only if you do, become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you want the bonus material that we give members, but you don't have the financial means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will work something out with you. We always do. All right. We'll be right back with Stephanie Tsotsi.
I belong to the stars.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Earth Justice Associate Attorney Stephanie Tsotsi on the case that I guess is ongoing, the lawsuit brought by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a sense? I mean, what is the lawsuit? Who are the who is the defendants in this case?
Sure. So we represent the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and our lawsuit was against the Army Corps of Engineers. And after we filed, the Dakota Access Pipeline Company intervened on behalf of the Corps. So now they're a part of the lawsuit, and they're defending the Corps' actions. And recently, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe intervened on our side. So they're plaintiff interveners and are helping us in our arguments.
Okay, and so just give us a sense of what is the contention of the lawsuit? I mean, I think the basic parameters of this case, I think our audience knows, and that is that the pipeline that this company is seeking to put, the Dakota Access Pipeline, runs, what is it, a half a mile upriver from tribal territory?
Yes, the multi-billion-dollar pipeline decided to construct right above the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and right under a water source that is a main source, our main source of drinking water for the tribe. And so this multi-billion-dollar pipeline put the burdens and risks of an oil pipeline right at their doorstep. And our claim, our big claim includes violations of the National Historic Preservation Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, and we also have some other smaller claims in there as well.
And so, all right, so what's the status of the lawsuit at this point?
So the larger complaint that we filed in July is still active. Right now there's been a lot of attention around the temporary restraining order and the preliminary injunction, and that's just a mechanism that we use to try and halt construction to some degree while we work out the larger issues in this case. So the bigger picture is still pending, and that's going to take months to set a schedule for, but right now we're focusing on halting construction under the National Historic Preservation Act.
And so give us a sense of like what you need to prove in that instance.
For this, right now, the temporary restraining order and the preliminary injunction, we are trying to show the court that the tribe is suffering irreparable harm and that the pipeline isn't injured by stopping construction, and that the harm to the tribe, who's been in the area since time immemorial and has cared for these cultural, historic, and sacred sites since time immemorial, definitely outweighs any harm suffered by the pipeline, and that our legal claim would prevail.
And what of the, I mean, can you give us a sense of the process in which this location, the locating of the pipeline took place?
Well, unfortunately, I can't. And part of that is because the tribe wasn't involved in the early stages of the pipeline development. And we do know that at some point the pipeline was routed north of Bismarck, North Dakota, and it was moved. And it is now placed right at the, almost right at the edge of the boundary of the reservation.
And so when it was at the, when it was placed in north of Bismarck, I mean, is there any public record as to why that switch took place?
It's discussed a little in the draft environmental assessment, but I can't give you a full reason as to why it was moved.
Is there a sense, or do you get a sense from activists that it's just a function of they complained and had more, I guess, political power in which to exert? Or is it, is there some type of, I guess, practical reason why it had to, cross this river just upriver from the reservation?
I think it may depend on who you ask. I can't really speculate as to the exact reasons why the pipeline was moved, and I'm not sure how much of it was for consideration of Bismarck's drinking water. Sorry.
Can you give us a sense of like what the potential implications are from a leak? I mean, how often do leaks happen with a pipeline like this?
Oil pipelines. They do leak. It's not a matter of if; it's a matter of when. What we have not reached at this stage is a level of specificity. We haven't gone into the full briefing, so in terms of the specifics of this pipeline and its risks of a leak, I can't really talk to that.
Okay, and so just give us a sense of how you anticipate the case going forward.
Well, right now we're waiting for a ruling on our preliminary injunction that should come on Friday, September 9th. Depending on what happens in that ruling, which way it goes, and how the judge rules in terms of how he describes, he gets some discretion in how that happens. There is a process to appeal. We don't know if either party is going to appeal, depending on what happens. And regardless of which way it goes on Friday, we will still have the larger claim, the first lawsuit that we filed, the complaint that we filed, and that will take months.
In the
short term, we're looking at what's going to happen on Friday. But there is a long-term legal process that goes along with this.
And construction continues in and around the area in which of the reservation.
Well, right now construction is stopped for a very small portion outside of the reservation. If we lose the preliminary injunction on Friday, then yes, construction can continue throughout the whole pipeline route.
All right. Well, Stephanie Soci, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, so that's where we are from a legal standpoint, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jordan Chariton. He has been on the ground in North Dakota. In fact, I think he literally has just landed from his flight from North Dakota, and he'll give a sense of what's going on in the ground there. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jordan Chariton. He's just returned from North Dakota, is my understanding. Literally has just returned, or has not even quite returned, per se. Jordan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. Did I just say TYT reporter? Sorry, a little discombobulated. All right, so, Jordan, thanks for joining us. I know you've just literally gotten off an airplane. Tell me how long were you out at Standing Rock?
I was there for 2 days. I got there Monday and kind of hit the ground running and just leaving today.
And so give me a sense of what you saw. How many folks are protesting, and your general impressions?
Yeah, there's a main camp that has thousands of people kind of camping out there. There are Native people who are from North Dakota there, but there's also a very big portion that's from out of state. Native Americans from around the country who have come in to kind of show their support to the local tribes fighting this pipeline. There's actions every single day. They call some of the actions soft actions, which is the more peaceful kind of protest, and then harder actions, which include Native Americans chaining themselves to some of the construction bulldozers and machines. So I was able yesterday to interview a brother and sister, both separately chained themselves to construction machines, which ended up, thwarting construction for the day. Obviously they can't use the machines if there's human chained to them. So I saw and did interviews from scenes like that. I also went into some of the local camps that Native tribes actually live in year-round. And, witnessed everything from ceremonies to how they live daily. The mood is definitely tense. It kind of goes from sadness to anger to joy within the hour, because there's a lot of music and celebration and dancing that goes on, too.
And give me your sense of my understanding is that there's the outside the attendance of outside tribes is nearly unprecedented, at least in the past couple of decades. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's actually what several people I spoke to told me, that they haven't had this kind of congregation of tribes in more than 150 years.
Oh, wow.
And more people are kind of coming in as we speak. I've had many, many people reach out to me asking if it's too late, if they could come. What's interesting also is it's not just Native Americans. I've seen a lot of, progressive, Caucasian volunteers and just people who are taking an interest. I think one thing I've really noticed, and even within myself, is obviously we know our history and we know the Native Americans have been, disregarded, treated poorly, but you don't really know to the level until you're there. And very powerful interviews I've been able to do. One Native American in a tribal ceremony I witnessed kind of broke down in tears, telling America to wake up. And, the Native Americans forgave, have forgiven and moved past our history, obviously, of Native Americans being displaced and murdered. But how much more forgiveness can we offer as you try to bulldoze our sacred burial sites and taint our waters? So it's really ground zero, I would say, for the Native American tribes, but also people around America that are now really waking up a little bit to how Native Americans are still being treated.
I mean, in terms of the people who have come there to support the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and particularly outside of other tribal populations, I mean, give me a sense of what the what's driving that. Is it an environmental? I mean, are they environmental activists? Are they Native American activists? I mean, how is that How is all that sort of that pastiche, if you will, how is that sort of coming together?
Yeah, I would definitely say the biggest block of people coming in are actually Native Americans from around the country. You know, if I had to give you a rough estimate, I'd say maybe, 30% are non-Native Americans that I've come into meeting. I think it's kind of a mix, I don't think it's just not just the Greenpeace kind of folks out here and environmentalists. I met many people that I met on the road from the Bernie movement who are here. Progressive people. You meet a lot of people who are kind of just working in their daily lives, and this stood out to them. A lot of people from Minnesota, for some reason. I must have met a block of 50 people from Minnesota who drove over. So I think there are environmentalists, but there's also just a very big block of progressives and kind of Green Party members, because this story kind of merges environmentalism with racism, with all those things. And also there's a lot of people I met that were on the front lines on Keystone XL that are also here. So I'd say it's a good mix of a lot of environmentalists, but also a lot of just progressives who are fighting against, what they deem to be another case of corporate greed.
Give me, to the extent that as you were reporting out there, how the pipeline came to be situated or planned to be situated a half a mile upriver from the reservation, when originally it was supposed to be about, 10 miles upriver from Bismarck. What do you know about that?
Yeah, it was originally supposed to run through Bismarck. The pipeline company, Energy Transfer Partners, got a big dose of pushback, and they relented on doing it there. And, the difference between Bismarck and this area is way more impoverished and is filled with Native Americans. So the oil company did not consult the Native Americans on this land and basically decided, all right, we're getting very fierce opposition up here. Bismarck is definitely a little bit more populated and is not concentrated predominantly by Native Americans, so they decided to run it through pretty much right next to where burial sites are and these tribes live. The Army Corps of Engineers, apparently okayed it, and just now after the first construction sites kind of bulldozed and desecrated these lands is when President Obama and the Army Engineers came out in favor of that restraining order, and also suddenly after the fact saying climate considerations need to be taken into effect. But essentially, Bismarck said no. It's not a wealthy area, but the at least more stable and better off economic area said no, and they decided to run it through here. The Native Americans I spoke to in the tribes said they would never consulted before construction started.
My understanding too is that the EPA had recommended the EPA was actually one of three federal agencies that raised environmental and safety objections to that North Dakota section of the pipeline, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers ignored those things. Have you heard much about that?
Yes. I heard the same things. And I kind of heard, the Army and the Army engineers kind of waxing and waning over distance to burial grounds and the actual distance to the tribal land, saying that this is not close enough to their land. I read things about specific mileage was their reasoning. I mean, at the end of the day, this is their water source. This is what they live off of. So, but yeah, I did read that the EPA had raised objections on climate concerns, and it was ignored.
I guess it was also the Department of the Interior, which would obviously deal with directly with the Native American tribes, raised some issues in terms of the burial grounds. What else should we know from having your couple days there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really outside of just the, kind of moving ceremonial things I saw, it's not just the issue of the pipeline. I mean, these Native American tribes, I learned a lot about how there's a lot of violence within the tribes. There's a lot of outside people coming in, kidnapping women, raping women. There's been a very big epidemic of missing women that the government has really not done that much for the Native American women. Jill Stein has been down here, and yesterday we got kind of a little bit of a testy exchange. She was down at the construction site that got stopped due to the protesters chaining themselves. But, she was trying to talk to some of the natives, and not really anger towards her, but just anger at the politicians in general, basically giving them empty rhetoric. They asked, what are you going to do about our missing tribeswomen? What are you going to do about the epidemic of sexual assault, where we have no right to fight for ourselves and no legal defense? So outside of the pipeline, there's just other issues that are very, that are very unique to these people and this land that are being more spotlighted, I would say. The other thing is, it really seems that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing in terms of the EPA, the Army of Engineers. President Obama kind of came in after the fact. It seems like this was very hastily pushed through this Native Americans' land when, a more affluent, or at least more, I would say, more traditional suburban area in North Dakota said no. There wasn't pushback by the oil company against Bismarck. As soon as they got shut down, they moved on to this land. So I think, it is very emblematic of what's going on, around the country. If you can't build here, let's go find somewhere with, poor and low-income people. It's what I just saw when I was in Indiana with the lead crisis going on there. They built, low-income housing with African Americans on top of, a lead smeltering plant, essentially. So I think that's what you're seeing. It's unfortunate. And you're also seeing through this judge's ruling yesterday, half of the construction was halted, but the other half, unfortunately, where the burial sites are, is allowed to continue. The judge said he doesn't have jurisdiction over that land.
Jurisdiction, or she, the judge doesn't have jurisdiction over that land because it is, it is not U.S. federal land. It's reservation land, why doesn't the judge have jurisdiction over that land as opposed to the other land?
That I couldn't tell you. I didn't show up in the. I haven't read the judge.
Did we just lose you? We did. Well, that was Jordan Chariton, from the Young Turks. You can check out the Young Turks site for, I imagine, they have already released or will be releasing Jordan's videos that he's been taking down there. So,
and just a note on Bismarck, they're talking about why it might have been moved. Bismarck is 92% white. So that's when he's talking about like a sort of suburban area and like more politically powerful. I think that's another big part of it too. Like the racial,
just a sheer on a racial element.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's you can't necessarily disaggregate the idea of a place like North Dakota and where the political power lies. Right. I mean, it's a pretty white state, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah. Very white. And, I mean, Bismarck's a state capital, too, so that's,
It's your neighbor now is a state legislator, and you're going to get a lot more attention But I mean, this is, you know, we spoke about this the other day. If you want to know where, if you want to know where a poor population is in any given city or state, look for the infrastructure. Look for where the power plants are. Look for the where the power stations are. You will find it in their neighborhoods. That is the nature of, politics, isn't it? Probably not just in this country, but certainly in the way that we structure things here. I mean, all right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is the first, I guess, presidential forum. Yeah, it's the first, closest thing that we're going to have to a debate between Clinton and Trump. Trump is going to be, my understanding is it's going to be on NBC and MSNBC. Starting at 8 p.m., Trump will be interviewed for... Clinton will be interviewed first by Matt Lauer. Trump. And it's going to be interesting to see. We have some sound to get a notion. Trump was clearly practicing, right? I mean, he pretends like he's not. First of all, I don't buy it for a minute. He's practicing doing the debate thing. Of course he is. And he had a practice session, which was a military town hall chaired by General Michael Flynn in Virginia Beach, Virginia yesterday. That's, you know what we call that? Practice. Let's just play one clip. Okay. Just as a little teaser before we go into the fun half. Of Donald Trump's, now remember, he's sparring with a guy who is looking to be in his administration. Now, Matt Lauer is no vicious animal when it comes in terms of in terms of being a reporter. But I have seen him at times be a little, here's the interesting dynamic, and I think this is true of all the moderators of all the debates. There isn't the same typical dynamic that we see in most of these presidential elections. In other words, you're not going to see, there isn't the same pressures on these moderators to be seen as being completely unbiased. I think there is, at least I've noticed in the press, a greater willingness, broadly speaking, to acknowledge that Trump is a liar, right? I mean, we see this on CNN Chirons. The head of NBC said that Trump is a scumbag. I don't know if Matt Lauer cares what his ultimate boss says, but in terms of like pressure on him, I would think it's less. So I think we're going to see a fairly aggressive, I mean, look, if I'm Matt Lauer, I want people to think that I'm smart. And if I can go in with a full-on policy, make this all about policy, I can go at Trump and Clinton just as hard. And I have a good sense of who's going to come out the other end. So here is Trump's practice session with Michael Flynn, former General Michael Flynn of the DIA. DIA. He's also a bit of a lunatic. You know, sometimes things happen when you get older. All right, but here he is. And listen to Trump talking about cyber stuff.
And to stay on ISIS a little bit, because this is a really, I think this is an important topic, and it's certainly it's one of the national security threats that our country faces today. You have described at times different components of a strategy, military, cyber, financial, and ideological. Can you just expand on those four a little bit?
Well, that's it. And, you know, cyber is becoming so big today. It's becoming something that a short number of years ago, wasn't even a word. And now the cyber is so big. And, you know, you look at what they're doing with the Internet, how they're taking, recruiting people through the Internet. And part of it is the psychology, because so many people think they're winning. And, you know, there's a whole big thing. Even today's psychology, where CNN came out with a big poll. Their big poll came out today that Trump is winning. It's good psychology, you know. It's good psychology. I know that for a fact because people that didn't call me yesterday, they're calling me today. So that's the way life works, right? But I think we're doing very well. And I really thank the state of Virginia. So many different places have been so incredible. So I thank you very much. But cyber has been very, very important. And it's becoming more and more important as you look. And a lot of it does have to do with ideology and psychology and lots of other things. You know, we're in a different world today than we were in 20 years ago and 30 years ago. And one of the biggest problems, or one of the reasons that we have to knock them out, is because the weaponry is so powerful today.
Turn off my soundboard. Just had an aneurysm after listening to that. Just to be clear, let's just go back to the question he was asked. Just to cue it back up to the question he was asked. Just so you remember that.
And to stay on ISIS a little bit, because this is a really, I think this is an important topic, and it's certainly at the, it's one of the national security threats that our country faces today. You have described at times different components of a strategy, military, cyber, financial, and ideological. Can you just expand on those four a little bit?
Well, that's
pause.
It.
Okay, cyber. We don't need to hear the answer. In of the four components that the general laid out for him to expand on, cyber, military, financial, what was the other one? Diplomatic? What was it?
Psychological.
Was it psychological? Let's play it again.
Important topic, and it's certainly at the, it's one of the national security threats that our country faces today. You have described at times different components of a strategy, military, cyber, financial, and ideological.
Ideological.
Can you just
expand
okay. on those four a little
so
bit?
So you had four components, and cyber, military, ideological, financial, that would be like freezing their assets or perhaps closing down trade routes. Trump got to one of them. He got to cyber. And cyber's big. Cyber's really big. And he was also adept enough to know that 30 or 40 years ago, we didn't even have the word cyber, although we probably did. Yeah. It just wasn't used.
The word cyber came into usage in the 80s, and it comes from cybernetics, which goes back to Plato. So.
Well, that doesn't matter. In the way that it means now. We didn't have cyber, but it's big now. And then there's also psychology. And how does he know this? Because he was up a point in a CNN poll. Now, it's quite possible that tonight during the Commander-in-Chief Forum that he will get away with an answer like that. But I got to think Matt Lauer will just sit back and go, I'm sorry. Could you talk about the other three components? Oh, they're big, too. They're super big. Military, we didn't have... There wasn't even a word military 5,000 years ago.
Guns
not
are
in
just
English.
So much bigger.
He sounded a little bit better, or a lot better than, you know, at his rallies and his other speaking engagements in that clip. But the cracks in that facade are just so near the surface that it's laughable, because this is the friendliest environment possible. And even when the audience started clapping, he completely went into his normal rhetoric.
Yeah. And the thing is,
so
he's coming off that.
He's,
yeah. He's coming off. He's going, I got this. I got this. You said I was with it. I was going toe to toe with the general.
Right. Yeah. That demeanor, it doesn't seem to matter to a lot of people that it's what he's saying is basically has no connection to the question or, you know, reality. And it's just dumb. It's the dumbest thing ever.
But
But he can't even maintain that tone.
Let me push back on
that tone.
It doesn't matter to Trump voters. But if there is someone there who says, just like, excuse me?
No, I know. That's what
then
I'm saying.
I think this, that's what's going to be really interesting about tonight. All right, we got to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. We've got another piece of sound about Trump where I like what he was saying about Iraq, and something like this will go over well tonight. And this could be, you know, something like this is like problematic. I mean, he's practicing here. He's practicing. And then we've got some clips of Pam Biondi. The other interesting thing about this, too, I should tell you, is if this Pam Biondi thing, this whole pay-to-play, it maintains in the media until the next debate, it'll be interesting as well. Julian Assange on Sean Hannity last night. These guys... It was wonderful to see Hannity come together with Julian Assange.
It choked up.
Also, you know, we've dug up a clip from the only conservatives I really have any respect for. I got to be honest with you. And I respect them just because, I mean, obviously I disagree. I couldn't disagree more with just about everything they say. But these guys, credit where credit's due, back in April 7th, of this year, they had nailed the whole thing. Hillary is sick, big time. I mean, totally big league. And we'll play that plus the clip of Gingrich literally having a coughing fit in the same interview where he's suspicious of Hillary Clinton's coughing fits, but he has a reason for his. But who knows? Maybe this is a cry for help. And then we'll maybe play a clip of that moron, Jesse Waters. All right, we'll be right back. 646-257-3920. I'll take your IMs.